today, the world just changed. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analysis. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news, Friday afternoon. And Tarek is back for another chat. Tarek, what a momentous week.
It hasn't ever been, mate. You know, and I think the thing that's really sort of rammed home just how much things have changed is just how quickly everything, you know, all the players are just scurrying around and just, you know, changing their commentary. You know, even the likes of the RBA are just like, well, lots of stuff. We just did our statement on monetary policy, but it's kind of gone out the window.
Well, it's fascinating because, of course, we had the US election result much quicker than expected. Trump, stole the show completely. And interestingly, of course, the Fed in the US and the Bank of England both cut rates by 25 basis points and both said, well, we can't tell yet what the implication of this change of government's going to be. But I think for me, the most relevant point is this. Whatever else people felt was important in terms of policies and what have you, the hip pocket and the economy stupid really haunts, right? The point was that the majority of people in the US felt that the incumbent government had not done them well in terms of the cost of living. And of course, Trump pushed that really hard. And, whatever else is important and whatever else people want to position, it is the economy stupid.
It is. And I think it's also just how that economy is experienced by the individual, you know, how they see their own financial fortunes, how they interact with the economy. You know, like say for instance, in the US, one of the key input costs for a lot of people who don't have employer funded healthcare is healthcare. And even for those who do have employer funded healthcare, some of them have deductibles and other out of pocket costs. And, you know, I don't think that there's really been enough mind paid to all these little individual things that, in particular, things like health insurance, which aren't at all properly captured by the US CPI. You know, you look at the US CPI and you just go, well, how can that possibly be true? You know, like, you know, the US insurance component over the last 12 months, I believe, is down or only recently just went into positive territory. And if you ask an average American, hey, is your health insurance cost gone down? They're going to go, what are you talking about? Of course not.
Well, that's the point. And of course, the official statistics in Australia are pretty much as bad. The living costs data from the ABS, which came out recently, showed that in fact the true cost of living, even on their methodology, was a lot higher than the inflation rate. And certainly in my surveys, I see a lot of people, wincing under the cost. And it's worth just highlighting again, to state the obvious, even if the inflation rate comes down from a high peak, you've still got much higher plateau costs than where they were 2 or 3 years ago. And of course, it's the cumulative effect of that over time. Plus, of course, the fact that interest rates are still higher, a lot higher than where they used to be. And most people are still expecting that interest rates will stay higher for longer. And the bond rates, of course, the last 2 or 3 weeks have gone significantly higher too, which again signals that the cost of money is going to be higher. That's going to put more pressure, of course, on government budgets as well, who are borrowing like there's no tomorrow. And so that the whole economic foundation question is fascinating. Now, of course, Trump's saying, well, we'll be able to solve that by tariffs. Observation, tariffs tend to be inflationary.
Indeed. And something I wanted to ask you just before I forget is, how are you seeing the evolution of just sort of like arrears and hardship provisions for people with mortgages here in Australia? Because, you know, I feel like that's a bit of a blind spot for us where there's all sorts of regulatory changes and extended pretend that's occurred since the pandemic kicked off. And I feel like that's obscured the true picture of things from a position where we didn't really have a great picture to begin with.
Well, we don't have a good picture to begin with. And I would make three observations. NAB came out this week with their latest results and actually said that the default rates were actually on the rise. And that is consistent with other data from some of the other credit agencies, particularly actually non-bank lending defaults are high. But of course, the whole hardship program, which allows people for up to a year, say, to be able to, not make repayments or make only interest payments or whatever, or even extend the loan term, has been quite active. Even Westpac, I think, said that they'd have more people coming through, although they actually said maybe it's coming down a little now. We'll see about that. So anything that's put through the hardship scheme, that loan is then classified as okay. So that's not in the in the too hard basket, as it were. Then the other point is, of course, that the banks are quite willing and able to extend the loan term. And we're seeing a lot of loan extensions happening and more people switching to interest-only loans to try and get by. Now, the predicated thought there was that, well, rates will come down quite quickly and that means that we'll be able to get through. Trouble is that at the end of that, and we're what we're seeing now, is that people are still in some difficulty, and that what they then do is to decide to sell. So if the person, the vendor, the mortgagor, owns the property, decides to sell, that is not seen as a distressed sale. And so the actual distressed sale count, slightly up, but not dramatically up. But the under the hood story is the number of people who decide at the end of the day that they cannot make their property work anymore and then put it on the market because prices are still quite elevated. They can sell, get out, pay the bank, and perhaps end up with a little bit of cash remaining. But then, of course, have to find somewhere to live. Now, that's the story that nobody's got a handle on because there is no good statistical basis to get that information anywhere. I see some of it in my surveys. And interestingly, at the moment, unless you're in Melbourne, there's a big problem in Melbourne, most people who have to sell can sell and get out and, you know, retain their shirt just, even if they don't want to do it. They have to do it. Banks are quite clever with this because they're pushing the story about, maybe you should do something, but are not forcing foreclosure unless things are really, really bad. So the default rates, as reported by the banks, are still remarkably low. But I think it's that process which is running at the moment quite fast. And by the way, Western Australia is where some of the most significant vendor forced sales are at the moment.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, you know, the info that I have seen on hardship provisions, now this data is almost a year old at this point. I think this was from ASIC. The average mortgage of someone currently in trouble is about $312,000. Now, compared with today's average mortgage, it's in a completely different galaxy. And I think it's just worth, you know, sort of underscoring that these people in trouble are generally people who aren't that new to the game. They're people who've been around for a while. So it's just something that takes time to sort of, you know, to feed through the python, so to speak. So I think it's going to be really interesting just the next 12, 18, 24 months because a reality is dawning that we're not going to get that many rate cuts, that we're only going to get a couple. You know, maybe it's two, maybe it's three, maybe it's four. That's sort of, you know, where we're at the moment. You know, if I believe the current market pricing is for about two in the next 18 months.
Yep.
A lot of people are going to be pissed off about that because a lot of people were promised this, you know, this big rate cut cycle, everything's going to go back to normal, everything's going to be fine. And I think once the sort of reality begins to set in that that's not going to be the case, that's when we could really start to see the rubber meet the road. And that's probably something that, you know, we're probably going to be talking about, I would imagine, somewhere, you know, or around about the second half of next year.
Well, you're talking about seasoning there. It does take time. And if you look at the trends, I mentioned WA earlier on, the trigger for the problems in WA are 4 or 5 years old. Because that's when we had significant increases in lending as property prices started to fall. People can muddle through for quite a long time. And certainly in my surveys, people reach for credit cards, they reach for other loans, they refinance a couple of times. Equity mate might play into it as well if property prices are rising, and we see quite a lot of equity mates still going on at the moment. But if the cash flow story doesn't correct, ultimately, they have a problem. And that's what I'm seeing. And, you know, I measure mortgage stress, of course, you know, cash in, cash out. And that's a very early indicator. And I do believe you're quite right that over the next year or two, we're going to see quite a lot of this come to the surface. Now, rates will get cut, probably not this year, almost certainly not this year. CBA, please note. Even they've admitted now that it will be next year. But it could be May or later, which may not help Albo if he goes to the country before May. We may get one cut, who knows. But I think the end game is for higher rates forever. And there are three reasons for that. Firstly, the anomalous, almost close to zero rates was a combination of COVID and you know the global financial crisis. But everyone now recognizes that those ultra-low rates didn't help, really. They just created a huge issue. Secondly, the amount of debt that's in the system, and particularly government debt, is continuing to rise and will continue to rise. And that higher rate is going to put a lot of pressure on the government as well, which is going to put pressure to increase taxes, not decrease taxes. And the tax take is already really high around the world, including in Australia. And then the third thing is that the get-out-of-jail property price rises that we've seen over the last few years is predominantly driven by one, migration, and two, very low interest rates. Well, interest rates are now higher. Migration is coming off the peak. So you put all that together and you would say, well, you know, the world is now in a very different place. We said the world has changed. And whilst that might be a slow change, it might be a fast enough change to have a profound impact on the next election.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that Albo is in a fair bit of difficulty here. And to be completely fair to him, it's not entirely self-inflicted. A lot of it is, but it's not entirely self-inflicted. I mean, I think there's a strong argument to be made if the states weren't spending quite so strongly on taxpayer-funded job creation, that Albo probably would have got his rate cut in 2024.
Yeah.
And he'd be, you know, I wouldn't say he'd be sitting pretty, but he'd be, you know, sitting a lot more comfortably than he is today. So it's going to be interesting to see how all that plays out, because I'm not sure if the labor market, I mean, this is something where I've got to put my hand up and say, I got that wrong. At the start of this year, I looked at the job ads deteriorating. I looked at the level of employment growth deteriorating, hours worked deteriorating. And I concluded, we're in trouble. We're in trouble. You know, I thought we would have seen rate cuts this year, but the reality is that I was right about the private sector. The private sector has well and truly gone off the boil. If the level of employment growth in the non-market sector was similar to normal, we would be seeing, you know, 5.5-6% unemployment right now. But that's not what's ended up happening. So we've basically seen the government in general, come to the rescue of the labor market. And that's been at the cost of higher inflation and higher rates for longer. So, you know, one gets it wrong, but one got it wrong for a very, very interesting set of reasons.
Well, it goes back to this question of market jobs and non-market jobs, this new definition which has now been trotted out, and essentially how many of the jobs are directly or indirectly paid for by the government. And, you know, that's the story, really, because pretty much all the jobs growth is government jobs, directly or indirectly. So, for example, you know, in the healthcare sector. But it comes back to that's the reason why the productivity story is so weak at the moment. And, of course, Michelle Bullock always talks about, well, we need to get productivity up, but there's no real incentive from the government to do that at the moment. But, of course, the point of this is that you have to pay as a government, both the state and federal level, for that higher level of debt. And it's worth just, I think, contextualizing that conversation with what's happened in the UK. So we had a new government in the UK, a Labour government, and they, before they came in and said, we're not going to lift GST, VAT, you know, that sort of the purchase tax, we're not going to lift income tax, and we're not going to lift national insurance. The national insurance is effectively what's paid by individuals as part of their deductions to cover future health costs and pensions. But the budget that they had a couple of weeks ago put a massive impost not on the national insurance paid by individuals, but by the national insurance element paid by the corporates, both large and small businesses. They also slugged a whole lot of additional stuff on the transfer taxes, because there are death duties effectively in the UK. So over a certain level, you have to pay so much to the government, up to 40% in some cases. And they've done a number of other things in the UK. They also did some other stuff down at the young end. So the rate of pay at the base rate for young people, you know, the minimum wage and the next group up, was put up dramatically. And if you stand back and look at this, and for example, they also put additional taxes on transferring farms above a certain level from one generation to the next, what you're seeing is the government in the UK has now pivoted to being even more debt driven. So they lifted the overall deficit dramatically. But very interestingly, they've now started to focus on the asset pools that current people have and are raiding those asset pools and inserting themselves effectively from one generation to another generation, because that is actually the only source of available funding right now. I think there's an object lesson there for the Australian story, because we're seeing, and I think we will see, similar things in Australia. And it shows you that this intergenerational shift and where the money is going is now a really big issue.
100%. 100%. I mean, we've already seen here in Australia the increase in the cost of aged care for people with the assets to pay for it. So I think that's only the beginning. You know, the retirement and aged care costs of the boomer generation are going to be enormous. They are going to be huge. And people say, oh, well, migration will pay for that. Oh my, no. No, it won't. It's not going to get close. It's not going to get... I mean, we can't even build enough... We don't even have the money to build enough infrastructure to keep up with the migration, let alone for that money to then flow off to fund all the various pensions and aged care and healthcare for, you know, the older generations. And of course, I mean, they're going to look at things like super and they're going to go, ooh, are we going to use this to force super funds to buy government bonds, to buy them at yields that are extremely unattractive? But, well, we can make them do it, and they're going to have to just, you know, deal with it. Or are we going to see the assets of older generations further raided by, you know, them saying, well, your house is worth $3 million, so you're going to have to pay X number more in aged care costs. And, you know, I've heard from quite a few people, from people who've had their parents in aged care over a prolonged period. And in a lot of cases, if you're talking about people with, you know, three or four brothers and sisters, a lot of the time there's nothing left. This whole idea of, oh, you know, millennials and stuff are going to inherit all this money, you know, and the average. No, not really. It's Toyota Camry. It's closer to Toyota Camry money than it is to life-changing cash. And don't get me wrong, there are some people who will, but that's mostly the wealthy transferring assets and income-producing assets to the wealthy.
Yeah, well, there was an interesting report that showed that the intergenerational wealth shift is already happening. But of course, it's not uniformly spread. As always, we keep saying, you know, there are some people doing quite well, but there are others not. And unfortunately, this is the story that we're going to see more and more of. So higher taxes... I don't see any way taxes will come down. We're going to see these asset pools attracting more and more sharks to try and actually find a way of funding things. And I think that there's only a one-way street here. And look, there's an interesting early indicator, because of course they put the superannuation 3 million above, you know, we'll start charging you on the movement of value in that fund. So unrealized gains effectively. That is a very interesting and very concerning indicator of how government's thinking.
It's just throwing whatever they can at the wall and seeing what sticks, because they know that they've got problems. You know, it's all well and good right now, you know, for the Queensland government, the federal government to spend big, to create all these jobs, to give people all these handouts. But the reality is you look at the numbers from Treasury, say the federal Treasury, and it's, in terms of the actual structural state of the budget, it's red ink as far as the eye can see. You know, like decades and decades of red ink. So, you know, they're going to have to come up with the money from somewhere. And I think even you just look at just tax concessions more broadly, eventually they're going to become untenable. You look at, you know, you look at superannuation tax concessions, negative gearing, the capital gains tax discount. All these things are going to become untenable as people have to pay more and more and more of their income. And not only that, but you're generally talking about a taxpayer base who, for the most part, has never benefited from all those things. Yet it's going to be their taxes funding the benefits, the healthcare, and everything else for the generations who did. And if someone gets up there on their soapbox and loudly proclaims that Trump style, I think that there could be an opportunity there for an opportunistic populist to say, you've got shafted, you've had the ladder pulled up in, pulled up by the previous generation who was in front of you, and now you're the one who has to pay for it. And that's not fair.
And indeed, if you look at the Trump story and the Elon Musk, Mr. Efficiency, well, maybe there is actually going to be some focus on reducing the size of government because big government we've got in Australia, big government we've got in the UK and across most of Europe at the moment. The question is it productive government? And the true story is that quite often big government just means higher taxes, but no more efficiency and less productivity.
No, well, yeah, pretty much. I mean, speaking of government, we should probably get into the slides on the US election.
Yeah, let's do it.
As usual, everyone, the charts are available at burnouteconomics.com. If you would like to subscribe on a paid or on a free basis, it would be very, very much appreciated. And we'll get straight into it. Now, what we're going to do here is we're going to go through a little bit of a post-mortem on the US election. We're going to look at basically what transpired in terms of the electoral math, and then we're going to look into some of these sort of underlying trends that created that those conditions, and then we're going to get into a few reasons as to why that may have resulted. Now, first we've got this is just the Electoral College map for the presidency, and Trump won every swing state, all of them, and that was quite a shock to to all the pundits who were predicting this very, very close election, this very much 50-50 sort of close run thing, and it wasn't close run at all. I mean, I think this is one of the first elections I remember sitting looking out the window and saying, oh, it's still daylight, and they've already called it.
Yes, it was very different from what the polls were saying. And, there was an Iowa poll that people were saying, oh, well, that's telling us something interesting, but very different from what actually came out. Once again, I think there are some big questions about the polls. Of course, they'll say, well, we've always had, plus or minus errors. But of course, in the US, the turnout is difficult to predict because people don't have to vote. And so they have to try and model who turns out and who doesn't turn out. But this is a, pretty much a clean sweep. And yeah, you're right, it happened very quickly.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting. I think that it just goes to show that pollsters are not so much still disconnected, because there's actually an interesting anecdote. Now, a French analyst, discovered back in September that there was a type of poll, and what the poll asks is do you think your neighbors will vote for? Not who will you vote for, but who do you think your neighbors will vote for? And he thought, well, this is going to be more accurate, because people will say, oh, well, my neighbor will vote for Trump, even though they won't perhaps admit it themselves. And what he found was this enormous gap. So what he did is he went on one of those betting aggregators, I think it was Polymarket, and bet $30 million on Trump. And he's cleaned up quite handsomely. And I just think it just goes to show that same issue that was present in 2016 is still present today. The sort of shy Trump voter, as they call them, is still a significant force.
Yeah, and interestingly, of course, he had quite significant representation from women and from certain other groups that perhaps weren't expected to vote for him. And it comes back to what my theory is: the hip pocket. It's all about the hip pocket, ultimately.
Yep, and we've got a couple of slides for that later in the show.
Great.
Now, this one is of the US House. As things currently stand, last time I checked shortly before the show, the Republicans were projected to win 220 seats, which is 2 seats above the 218 seats required for a majority. Now, whether that's going to be especially workable or not remains to be seen, because when you're talking about, wrangling 220 politicians who all have to vote the same way, with the exception with and you can only lose two of them, that can be quite tough because different people have different opinions, have different views, and everyone needs to be catered to in order to get that particular piece of legislation across the line, or there needs to be someone from the other side of the aisle who's willing to compromise. So that's going to be a really interesting one. And I think it's also just worth noting that you're talking about a rather large, sort of, let's not take, parliament, let's just call it a parliamentary body, and sort of, which is somewhat incorrect, but anyway, you're talking about something that's rather large. Now, it doesn't take much, a couple of special elections, a few scandals, and all of a sudden it's back to even Steven. And then Trump prosecuting his agenda through Congress becomes significantly more complicated.
Well, it also gives the opportunity for the old rogue, person who's been elected to hold basically the house up, unless they can actually get some particular things that they actually feel passionate about. So it does leave the door open for significant influence from a relatively small corner of the chamber.
Yeah, exactly. And that's especially somewhat rare in the House. Whereas in the Senate, if you've got a senator or two, when you're talking about something that's relatively fine, because it's only a 100-seat House, whereas Congress is well over 400. So it's going to be an interesting one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking of the Senate, currently it's 52-46 in favor of the Republicans. There are 2 seats left up for grabs in. Excuse me. There are 2 seats left up for grabs, and they are going not quite down to the wire, but I believe last time I checked, they were projected to just go to the Democrats, but it remains very, very close. So this is interesting not only for the present, but also for the future, because not all US Senate seats go up for grabs every election cycle. So winning more seats here could leave the Republicans in a better position for how things will look after the next set of midterms. And I know that it's, a bit exhausting to be thinking about the next set of US elections, but that's the way the system works. And with c congressional election cycles only 2 years, you've basically got about not much more than about 14 months worth of actual governing before you're, back in election mode all over again.
Which tells you that anything sort of dramatic is going to happen in the very early weeks and months of the new president. So once he's in at the end of January, February, March, April. So watch for those things that he can sign off. I believe tariffs are in that particular category, but some of the other stuff is going to have to go through the legislative process, which could be interesting.
Yeah, it's that first year. 2025 is going to be, well, it's going to be a very interesting year for US politics.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, talking of the various demographic breakdowns of how the votes broke, now, Trump made up significant ground amongst people of ethnic minorities outside the traditional three, which are Asian, Hispanics, and Blacks. But he also made up a whole heap of ground amongst Hispanics in particular. He went from 32% of the Hispanic vote in 2020 to 45% of the Hispanic vote in 2024. And it's also worth noting that Trump actually won the vote of Hispanic men. I believe it was something like about 54% of Hispanic male voters voted for Trump. Now, while Trump lost ground amongst white voters, that was more than made up for by the ground he gained amongst non-white voters. So it's really quite interesting to see how this sort of coalition of voters has coalesced around Trump, in the sense that, it was very easy to write him off for some in the past to say, well, he's just for white people. When you look at these numbers, that's very much not the case anymore. And, I think that Democrats have really just misunderstood the issues facing a lot of these minority groups. As I think that they focus too much on them being as part of a minority group and not enough as just being people, just being individual people with individual issues, which are, defined by their, you know, their station in life and where they may be, you know, where they may live geographically. And I think just on the topic of illegal immigration, just assuming that all Hispanics are going to vote for the Democrats because Trump is wants to deport a bunch of people. Well, that was a pretty sort of foolish strategy in hindsight. Well, we knew it was foolish at the time, but foolish in hindsight for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think the key here is aspiration is important, and you know, a lot of people want to be more wealthy, and you know, want to feel that there is a future for them. And you know, Trump actually, if you've sort of peeled back some of the onion layers, he was very much forceful on that you know, it's not been good, it will be better, even if he didn't really explain how it was going to be better. And I do think that that sort of aspirational message was actually something which really triggered a lot of reaction, which was positive. And as you say, very broad-based.
I think that's a good point. I think it's very much that Trump, while there's like the whole all the baggage that comes with him, that there's Make America Great Again is at its core for voters, a message of hope, a message of better days ahead, when things haven't been good for a lot of people for a long, long time. Now, it's incredibly vague. There's not really a whole sort of well thought out plan. You know, this isn't, you know, the New Deal or something like that, where there's, you know, this sort of detailed plan of how exactly that's all going to be accomplished. But at the end of the day, at the ballot box, it doesn't really matter. It'll matter in 4 years or 8 years' time when Trump or his successor goes to the polls and says to the Americans, "Give me another mandate for another 4 years." But for now, it's enough. And I don't think that the Democrats really had that message of hope of we're going to make things better in the same way that Trump did. And it's rather ironic, really, because that was the message they ran on with Obama. It's the message they ran on with LBJ and Kennedy and Clinton, but not this time.
No, indeed. And I do think that the Biden slip in the last week or so, when he was, you know, rightly or wrongly talking about the people who actually were on the other side as garbage. I mean, that was a mistake, clearly. He didn't mean it, but that, I think, didn't help either.
I do wonder if he meant it or not. I do wonder. You know, I mean, you know, he's that sort of guy. You know, he's the sort of person who, you know, doesn't mind just throwing in his little jab. I mean, that day where he was out at one of those events and he put a Make America Great Again hat on. That was just gold. You know, I mean, sometimes I wonder if he's just sending a little bit of a message. It's like you guys shouldn't have done that to me.
Could well be.
All right. Now, this is probably one of my favorite charts from the entire election, because it's easy for people to say, well, Trump won because red or purple states went more red than they did before. And under more normal circumstances, I would say that would have been a correct conclusion, but not this time. There was very, very broad-based swings away from the Democrats and to the Republicans, or from Harris to Trump, in places like New York and New Jersey and Illinois and Rhode Island, these states that are the bluest of the blue, you know, the heartland. I mean, on a 5% margin in New Jersey, if you think about some demographic changes being baked in over the next 4 years, you know, one could make the argument that maybe New Jersey might even be in play next time. Who knows? You know, maybe it's going to turn into a state that's actually going to have to be fought for instead of just taken for granted by one side or another. So I think this just speaks to just an American people who are frustrated, who want something different, even if the plan for that something different isn't really all that well fleshed out.
Yeah, well, it's often that the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence, right? That's something which you know, I see quite often. And you don't have to necessarily have detailed policy. It actually does come back down to aspiration, and I think advertising. And it's worth just highlighting how much money was spent on on advertising, a ridiculous amount, particularly in some of those marginal seats. Absolute carpet bombing in terms of political ads, and I think a lot of people just got fed up with it.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't surprise me. Okay, now this is an interesting one, because for the longest time, well, for decades now, the younger vote, people under 30, has very much been a Democrat heartland. It's been the place where they've really, really performed quite well. This is particularly true in the elections involving Barack Obama. But this time, the pendulum has swung back towards the Republicans, with Trump winning young male voters by 13 points. And he still made up ground even amongst women voters compared to how he performed in 2020 and how even the Republicans performed in 2022. And I think it's just worth noting that this was basically in some ways a perfect storm of conditions for the Democrats, in the sense that abortion as an issue was overturned by the Supreme Court, who, you know, basically then left it up to the states. And it's, you know, that was a real catalyst for getting a lot of female voters, particularly young female voters, out there to vote for Harris. So that was something that was very much in their favor, yet it was nowhere near enough. Yet they still saw that, you know, the vote move towards Trump, which is fascinating, really.
Yes, and wasn't expected. I think there was certainly some of the early thoughts were that there would be a significant support for Harris from that particular quarter, but it just didn't come through.
No, and it's actually really quite fascinating. I think one of the things that was interesting is someone posted this poll that showed that, because generally women break Democrat. That's not, you know, really a secret. But one of the things I thought was interesting is that Trump didn't win, but he equaled Harris when it came down to the breakdown of women who were married. Trump got hammered amongst women who weren't. Now, I think he lost that particular demographic by something like 25 percentage points. But I think that that's really just quite interesting that people, you know, who are married, who have children, who have all the things that come with it, the concerns that come with it, decided that, you know, to shift their support towards Trump and away from the Democrats.
Yeah, and this is interesting that quite a few people who I heard being interviewed said, you know, it wasn't that I agree with everything that Trump said, but, you know, on weighing up the two, there was enough in terms of what Trump was saying that kept me voting for him rather than not. And I think that's an important point. You don't have to agree with everything he says, and you might overlook some of the shenanigans and things, but still go with him.
It feels to me like a bit like Brexit. You know, Brexit wasn't very well thought out. You know, I think we all know that. You know, it's been executed extremely poorly. But it was about people sending a message that they were unhappy with the way things were being governed, that they were unhappy with not having their issues listened to, not having their concerns voiced the way they should have been in Parliament. And the number one issue at the time was immigration. And despite the fact that, you know, the Tories got up there, you know, 3, 4, 5 times and said, we're going to cut immigration, they never did. And they increased it. And that pissed a lot of people off. And I think that was a factor in the US election as well.
Yeah, I think you're spot on there. Always interesting to look retrospectively, because the tips of the icebergs are much clearer as you've gone past them rather than you're coming towards them.
Very true. Very true. Now, this was something that we were talking about earlier. This is the cost of the average family health insurance premium in the US over time. The growth in the average family health insurance premium between 1999 and 2024. As you can see there, the US CPI has cumulatively risen by 86%, whereas the average family health insurance premium has risen by 342%. Now, this is the thing, as I previously mentioned, that isn't measured properly by the US CPI because reasons. Now, I just think that it's stuff like this for when you can't, when you're struggling and you can't afford to get your kid an asthma inhaler or whatever it is, or a scan or a trip to the specialist. When you can't afford that, you're going to look for answers somewhere else, somewhere outside the traditional political norms. And I don't think that a lot of people can say that if they were in that same position, but they wouldn't at least consider doing the same thing themselves.
No, very true. And I do find that the whole question of expectations that people have to be able to get the basic services that they need, and particularly families need, is a critical thing. In Australia, by the way, the costs of insurance have also risen dramatically, and I don't think that the statistic in the CPI fully reflects the true costs of higher insurance. But that's including healthcare and also other types of insurance in Australia. It's a big sleeping issue, and I think it's something, again, which people haven't really fully understand the consequences of yet.
It's kind of wild, you know, because I mean, I hear from people every now and then, you know, people who are frustrated or annoyed, and they feel like they don't have a voice, and they just want someone to at least vent to about this stuff. You know, people saying, you know, about a $500 trip to, you know, to a medical specialist that their child needs, you know, and for some people, okay, they're going to get part of that back from Medicare, but some people just don't have the money for that,
Yep.
you know, in this kind of environment. And, you know, and the idea, not only that, but of having to pay something like that similar on an ongoing basis. Okay, there's the things like the Medicare safety net, and that helps. But for some people, you know, particularly people in that really crap zone between being able to qualify for a Commonwealth healthcare card, which can be an absolute godsend for people in areas where it's more accepted, and you know, sort of a level of income which allows you to sort of more adequately get by. If you're in that zone, that's one of the hardest zones to be in for Australians at the moment. You know, it's always hard when you're on the lowest rungs of society. That's just that that's I mean, that's an inherent part of life. But we're also starting to see that those people, because of the cost of living, that those people in that zone where they don't qualify for some of those benefits that you get when you're on the lowest of, on the lower rungs, where they're ending up in a lot of cases worse off than some of the people on the lower rungs in terms of their actual income that they actually have to spend once they're paid for all their costs. So it's a mess. And I think that in a lot of ways, Australia is primed for the same type of rise of populism that we've seen with Donald Trump, and we've seen in Germany and in other parts of Europe and just the world as a whole, because the current system doesn't work for a lot of people.
No, and in Australia, I would argue that the two sides of government are actually pretty much, joined at the hip in terms of a lot of the policies and a lot of thinking. So there is very little differentiation. And given the fact that the total support that both the major parties have were actually diluted last time around, there are going to be potential minor parties that could pop up and make quite a noise and could reshape the political landscape. So, and I guess the other point in Australia, people have to vote.
Yeah, well, one can hope that we sort of see, you know, a rise of accountability. Let's just call it that, shall we?
Accountability would be good.
Okay, now this is a chart based on numbers from the Independent Congressional Budget Office on the estimates for migration, which occurred, well, not above board, shall we say. So, because you know, people who've entered illegally or overstayed visas, etc. Now, as you can see here, it's enormous under Biden. This has played a this has played a significant role in impacting US wage growth pressures. It's played a significant role in impacted areas in terms of health services, in terms of social services, particularly in border states and the other states where they've sort of had seen surges in the number of illegal migrants. So it's really a sizable issue from an economic perspective, a social perspective, and a political one. And one wonders if the issue wasn't managed so badly by the Biden administration, if they wouldn't have got, if they perhaps would have been significantly more competitive at the ballot box.
Well, clearly migration was a significant issue, and of course Trump pushed it quite hard. I have to say that Democrats really didn't have, I think, a strong platform on that. And if you are actually one of those households who are struggling, and you're finding it hard to get by, and you look around and you see other people coming in and seemingly doing okay and just increasing the problem, no wonder you react.
Pretty much. And I think, the part of the problem is that people turn on their televisions at night. And this is something that a few people raised on camera, on air, in the areas hit by the recent hurricanes, in the American South. And, a few people have said, I've got my $750 or whatever it was from the federal government in my assistance, but for a lot of people, they didn't have flood insurance on their houses because, some of these places are, a couple of thousand feet up, and they just go, well, why would I need flood insurance? And, there are people who've then come out and said, well, if I'm getting only $750, why is the federal government putting migrants up in homes, in hotels? Why are they giving them debit cards to for mobile phones to buy food, to do all these different things when I don't have, two quarters to rub together? And I think that resonates with a lot of people. I think that there are a lot of people out there who believe that we should help that it's like we should help our own people before we start, helping others. And I think that that is a in a in a in an in an environment where people where some people don't have enough, and where they're not getting the support from the government they need. I think that can be a powerful message. And again, and I think that it doesn't just apply to people who are hard up against it. It applies to people who want their society to put their own citizens first.
Yep, I think that's right. And it resonates, I guess, also in Australia, where we've had very strong migration, keep the GDP high at all costs. But the consequences and implications are playing out now. And again, I suspect the next election, migration will be right up there as one of the issues.
Yeah, it's quite sad, really, because I mean, it is true that Australia is a nation of migrants, and I think that well-managed migration can be a very good thing, and it has been a very good thing for most of Australia's history. But when it's managed badly, it's bad for everyone. It's bad for migrants who come here, who face the challenging conditions of trying to get a roof over their head, without a rental history. It puts them in a position where they could be exploited just to get a roof over their head, or to get a job. And I think it's kind of just wild for me, to be honest with you, to think that people say, oh, well, being high migration is being pro-migrant. No. If you think that people being put in conditions where they're ripe to be exploited is being pro-migrant, take a look around in Australia. Or if you want to see it taken to its logical conclusion, take a look around in Canada. It's a mess, and it's horrible, and it's morally reprehensible, to be completely frank.
Yeah, no, I agree. There's certainly more to it than I think a lot of people will recognize, and a lot of the politicians will actually talk about. But again, I'm absolutely sure that that'll be one of the big issues to be discussed ahead of the next election. I just can see it now.
Yep, 100%. Now, this one is more just included because it's interesting. more than anything else. And what it basically shows is that if you are an engaged member of a political party, and this, I think, and this is when I say engaged member, you're not necessarily a card-carrying member as we know it in Australia, but if you're a registered Democrat or a registered Republican, the way you view the economy is defined by your political allegiance. Say, for example, just before Trump was elected in 2016, Democrats thought that the economy was great and Republicans thought it was awful. Trump gets elected in short order. Republicans think the economy is great and Democrats think it's deteriorating. And it flips and ebbs and flows like that. And it's just worth noting as well that the RBA has also done research into this, and the exact same thing is present here in Australia.
So actually, political persuasion influences the lens through which you see things, and therefore how you actually assess the, the current state of the economy, and therefore how you feel. It's a fascinating observation.
It really is, it's like, it's a mind-altering drug, just like political allegiance, not even once. You never see everything objectively ever again.
Exactly right. Objectivity. No, kind of that.
Okay. Now, this is something I find quite interesting because it's all well and good for a president to be elected in this big sweep, this big landslide, where they win the presidency, where they win Congress, where they win the Senate. You can see a few there from. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. So they, you get elected in this big sweep. You win the House, you win the Senate, you win the White House. Then comes the first midterm election after that election. There, in all likelihood, you will lose seats, and you'll lose a lot of them. I think it's about 20. The average is about 26 House seats on average will be lost in that first midterm election, and 4 Senate seats. It's just the way it works. I mean, you look after Franklin Roosevelt's second election there, he got absolutely hammered, and then hammered again, and then hammered again in the next midterms after that, and then Harry Truman got hammered again. And that's just the way it works. So I think that's a it's just interesting. Just it's all good for people to think, oh well, this means Trump is now God and he can do what he likes. But the reality is that the power that Trump has to be able to put through legislation through a friendly House and Senate is probably only gonna last 2 years unless he bucks the trend.
Yeah, very interesting. And it shows you, I suppose, that the political wheels continue to turn. And whilst it might be in theory of, a 4-year term between presidential elections, the truth is that for a lot of that period, there are already political battles going on to try and get to the next election point, the next election point. So it's a bit of a nuts system, isn't it, really?
It is. I mean, the idea of a 2-year election cycle, it doesn't really make much sense to me. It makes much more sense to just go to 4 years. And it's just, yeah, I mean, like I said, you end up with about 14 months of actual governing. I mean, you get elected in November, you don't start work until January. So there's 2 months out already. And then you've got to start fundraising and campaigning for the next election, not that long after, but it's the American way.
Yes. Well, at least in the UK, you sort of have an election and then they kick the old guy out and the new guy moves in through the, through the front door as the old guy's going out the back door, and then in 48 hours the new people are there. In Australia it can be a little bit longer because of the proportional representation sometimes, but nevertheless it's not, well, it's not years. But I have to tell you though, I still have the theory that from my observations of Australia and the UK, a lot of the political decisions that are taken in the light of the upcoming election. So even although it might not be 2 years, the shadow of the next election casts a huge influence on people's decision making for a number of years up to the next election.
Oh, absolutely. It's unfortunate, but it's the way things
That's the
work.
way it is.
Now, Shortly after Trump was elected, I think it was actually the very next day, the RBA assistant governor was, I believe, in front of a parliamentary committee, and he was asked, what's going to be the impact of Trump's election? And he basically said, the expectation is that Trump's election could put upward pressure on interest rates in terms of keeping them higher for longer around the world. And we're not immune to that. Excuse me. And then there's also the tariff side of things as well, which could also put up, which is part of why they see that, sort of upward pressure on rates. So it's going to be interesting. And I do wonder to what degree Albo is going to try and more directly scapegoat Trump if we don't get a rate cut before the next election. That could be interesting.
Well, it's clear that, the bond yields were already rising ahead of the election that's continued. And interestingly, if you look at the US bond rates now, they're still quite a lot higher than they were after the previous Fed rate cut, which is a bit weird. But if you argue that we're going to see tariffs, which will be inflationary, and the fact that the government deficits will be larger, particularly in the US, that's going to put upward pressure on bond rates. Bond rates, in turn, trickle through. So yeah, higher for longer is definitely the problem here. And even in Australia, of course, before that, there was an expectation of a much more gentle decline in interest rates. And the inflationary pressures in Australia still look to be quite strong if you look at the latest services data. And of course, the RBA decision on Tuesday was to do nothing. So I was interested in that Senate committee evidence. And I think we're going to see more of it. And as you say, interesting scapegoats that are available for those who want to grab them.
It's going to indeed. And just while we're on the topic of interest rate pricing, this was posted on Twitter to me, and it's now a photo finish as to whether or not we'll get a rate cut for May next year. Rate cuts are now no longer priced in for the first 4 months of the year, and even just looking at all the way out to September next year, you're talking about 1.6 rate cuts. I think if we're sitting here, what's that? Probably like more like next October,
Yes.
and there's only been one rate cut. My Lord, are some people going to be annoyed? And
Well,
Albo may wish he didn't win the next election at that point.
yeah. Well, interesting analogue. Of course, in the UK, Rishi went early because he was concerned about some of the underlying costs and didn't think he was going to get any benefit from a potential rate cut. And then, of course, they then cut rates a little bit earlier than expected, which is interesting. But you've got to say that the trajectory in Australia looks more and more like we're going to see rates not really coming down until later next year. And that's going to put a lot of pressure on households. The other factor, of course, is that we've got the China syndrome and whether, in fact, there will be more stimulus coming through from China. They keep talking about doing more. We could also find that if we have tariffs in the US that we get a lot of cheap Chinese goods coming into Australia, and that will have an interesting effect on some of the pressure. So there are a lot of international connection points here, but I have to tell you that I think a lot of the inflation problem in Australia is homegrown. Look at where we are with the gas prices, look at where we are with the high migration and the public sector jobs growth that we've spoken about and the big deficits. So whilst Albo will be able to sort of point to some of those international factors, the policy over the last 18 months or so is also part of the reason why rates are going to stay high for longer. People probably should bear that in mind at the next election.
It's going to be very interesting to see how Dutton frames that come election time. Because at the end of the day, I pretty much see Dutton pursuing most of the policies that have been damaging for Albanese to at least some degree. So you can't really turn around and say you want to take, you want to hack and slash, say the migration target or whatever, and then turn around and just go, well, whoops, 250, well, whoops, 300,000, well, whoops, pick a number.
Yeah.
You know, so that raises some really interesting question, because if we do see this huge reduction in migration that people are talking about, you know, to 160,000, which, believe it or not, is still going to be too high to sort of meaningfully address the rental crisis and the imbalance between housing supply and demand, basically any time within the next decade, is still going to be, you know, too high unless we start building significantly more houses. You know, you're going to have a problem. So Dutton's got some interesting options there. I think, you know, he's got a, you know, sort of a pathway to a shot at election, probably next, but not this upcoming election, but the one after it. But it's going to be interesting. I mean, I say that as things currently stand today, that Albo should win the next election as a minority government. But he's got another 6 months to still screw things up, and that's quite a long time in politics.
Yeah, well, we've got nobody under 16 can access social media. We've got the misinformation, disinformation bill, just to quote you a couple of things that are there bubbling up. And I have to tell you that if those are the issues that Albo thinks are the most critical ones for Australians, I think that's a really interesting observation as to the gap between real people's lived experience and what politicians think are important. And I just remind everybody that what happened in the US was that it was the hip pocket, it was the economy stupid that actually won the election for Trump.
Well, the final chapter of a burnout economic story is when the government, you know, facing an economic downturn or facing an election, decides to throw money at the people and reignites inflation. Now, I think that with Trump's election and with that structurally pushing up inflationary pressures and bond yields, that just got a lot more likely. And I think that if Albo feels like he's in a very vulnerable position politically at the next election, that he may turn to the money printer and just, I mean, he's already turned to the money printer in terms of throwing, you know, billions at households through the electricity subsidies, through, and you know, outside Commonwealth rent assistance increases, etc. So what's another 10, 20, 30, $40 billion between a prime minister and an electorate? You know, it's if he needs to spend big to win, I think that's the path that he's probably going to take.
Well, it's only taxpayers' money, you know. Who's going to notice?
Well, I think the thing is that a lot of these policies they're stupid, and you and I may think they're stupid, and the viewers may think they're stupid, but we're not. We're not the full encompassing of the entire electorate, and most people think that they're great. So, like even if you take something like, you know, so like the electricity subsidies, I think that's like 2/3 of people think that they're fantastic. You look at things like first home buyer grants, 2/3, you know, 55, 60, 65% of people think they're a great idea, even though they're a horrible idea, you know. So it's I think that's the what you sort of need to really, you know, keep in mind. That's something that I very much try to keep in mind, of you are not an average voter. You do not, you know, you do not see things like an average voter. So, you know, sort of try to look at it things through a lens of a normal person, not someone who consumes inordinate amounts of political news and reports and all the related paraphernalia.
You're saying we're a bit of an outlier. Yeah, I think that's probably true. Yeah, maybe sometimes I think to myself, maybe I should just go and be a hermit and not do any more of this stuff, because the more I look at it, the more I think how stupid everything is. And you know, the two sides of government, they're on the same there's two wings on the same bird. And I think so much stupidity going on, and you look at the rising debt levels and all those things. But you know, a lot of people are just trying to get by on on the normal day, and if the government offers them a bit of money, they're going to say thank you very much and just carry on.
Yeah, I think the thing is that It's somewhat easy for people like you and I who do the homework, who do the, you know, what is basically gets to the point of almost academic level research into this stuff, to say, well, this is X, Y, and Z. You know, this is why things are broken. This is how things are broken. You know, like this is what household consumer spending looks like in terms of the actual growth compared with 20 years ago, you
Yeah.
know, in real terms. And things are absolutely broken. But if you try and talk to a normal person about that, they're not, I mean, they're going to understand it if you present it in such a way that, you know, it's approachable, but they're not going to go out and do that research on their own. It's all very much abstract. It's all very, and not only that, but it's also a case of the boiling frog. You know, while you and I can go, well, this is what things were like 20 years ago, most people are going to be like, crap, that was an entire generation ago. How am I supposed to quantify that with through a lens that's in any way comparable with today? You know, which is, I think, part of the reason why I get so many people who are a bit older getting angry with what I'm saying, even though the data set supports it. But you know,
Yes, right. It was bad. It was bad then, but it's even worse now. But people say, "Oh no, it was worse then. I remember when I was paying 17%." Blah blah blah. I've had that conversation many, many times. Well, Tarek, I guess we've come to the end of the conversation here. But you know, I think to sum it up, the world has changed dramatically. The U.S. election, I think, gives us some very important clues to what may be happening in Australia over the next few months in terms of the political shenanigans up to the election here. But I would also highlight the fact that it is the hip pocket. It is actually the ordinary person and how they feel about things, particularly financially and economically, which will be right at the heart of everything that's going on. And I've also got the observation that some of the other stuff that politicians seem to think are important are much less important than that fundamental question of the economy and migration. So, to my mind, they're going to be the issues.
yep, and I think you know, to just you know take a moment to sum up, I think it comes down to a voice for the people, which talks to the politicians and tells them what our grievances are and the challenges we face. And that's a voice that they should listen to, but they don't.
Well, now they prefer to turn it off. They prefer to only allow the mainstream media and the academics and politicians to have a voice on social media. You know, some of the other stuff that we're doing could be regarded as something we shouldn't be doing under the proposed MAD bill. So yeah, interesting. Anyway, we'll continue to do our analysis and highlight the fact that our analysis is based on good analysis and data, which is a good place to start. But some of the consequences and implications are not necessarily what politicians want to hear.
No, and we're going to keep it up.
We certainly will. Tarek, thank you so much. Great conversation. I'll look forward to the next one as soon as we can do it.
Looking forward to it too, mate. Bye.
Cheers.